News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam will be talking with Dr. Phil Sloan and Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman about nursing homes and assisted living.
Yeah, really interested in talking with Dr. Sloan and Dr. Zimmerman. They're really two pioneers in issues that are going to affect all of us or are affecting us in our lifetimes, which is the aging of the population, assisted living, and nursing homes.
But first, we have some research that matters, and the first one is about families trusting or mistrusting doctors and their prognosis about a loved one.
You know, Christy, this is a really difficult situation. You know, we're all faced with being in the hospital, sometimes intensive care units, and having loved ones very, very sick, and the doctors coming out and telling us some critically ill news. And for you and I, we've had to deliver this news so many times. And the question is, what's that process like? How do people hear what is being said?
So this was a study that was published in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, focusing on what happens in those intensive care units when doctors give families information about loved ones. And they're looking a little bit about differences in how families receive or hear the comments made from doctors of whether they give specific statistics of the likeliness that their loved one would live or whether they say general comments like it's very unlikely that he or she will survive.
Yeah, you know, there are about 170 family members were given one of two scenarios. One was they were told that it's very unlikely that they're going to survive and that they're very likely to die. And the other is that, you know, that they were 10% chance of surviving and a 90% chance of dying, to see how did people hear that. And in both cases, they found that people's heard actually better prognoses than the doctors actually gave.
It was pretty astounding. When asked to give their estimate afterwards of their chances of survival, the study participants gave an average estimate of 26% when the doctor said the survival was very unlikely. And even when the doctor gave a 10% survival odds, the study participants walked away saying on average that their loved one had a 22% chance of making it.
So the question, Christy, is what do we take home from this? And if you're a listener out there and you've got a parent or you have a loved one in an intensive care unit, a doctor comes out and gives you a really, you know, really poor prognosis, do you question it? Do you have a conversation? Or does the doctors then need to say, do you want to hear what the prognosis is? Or do you want me to go over it in more detail? Or what does that really mean? Because, you know, I don't even know how often we're actually correct when we say those prognoses either, because we're talking about very poor chance of survival in either case.
Well, there's some studies showing that the doctors are fairly accurate at estimating the odds of a patient living to hospital discharge, but we're not as good in saying for a given patient when they will or will not die because it's much bigger than science. But in this situation, it's hard for us to know, is it that we're giving too much information to the patients and their families that they're not hearing what we're saying, or is it about trust, or what are the real issues that are making that miscommunication?
Or maybe the doctors don't know the families well enough that they're having these conversations with. But this is a critical juncture point. If you're in that situation, stop, take a breath, take more time. That's
absolutely
our recommendation, at least mine. What do we have next?
The next one is about another potential benefit to vitamin D. Do you take vitamin D, Adam?
I do take vitamin D. And in this particular study, it's talking about vitamin D and asthma. And I've got a child who also has asthma. So I was really interested in this particular study.
It is a great study. I take vitamin D as well and give it to my children. And this is about asthmatic children who have relatively low vitamin D levels in their blood may have a greater risk of having severe asthma attacks than those who have higher or normal levels of vitamin D in their blood.
Yeah, there were over 1,000 children who had mild to moderate asthma, and they found that 35% of these children had vitamin D insufficiency, and that the more the vitamin D insufficiency, the more likely they were to have asthma flares or have asthma that was out of control.
And so it wasn't so much of a causal relationship, or you couldn't say, well, X causes Y, but you could say that having the lower levels was associated. And the thought is that it has something to do with vitamin D's role in the immune system.
Yeah. And again, this is one of those no-brainer kinds of things, Christy. You know, if you're out there and you've got a child with asthma, you're probably checking some other blood work, particularly if it's a new diagnosis of asthma. You know, add a vitamin D level one. That's what I'm going to probably change my practice. And if it's low, I mean, they were low to start with. There are lots of good reasons, as we've already discussed. Give them supplements.
Absolutely.
I don't think we'd find much disagreement on it. So maybe if you have a child with asthma, maybe you want to ask your family doctor, primary care pediatrician, to check a vitamin D.
Great. Well, the next one we have is about weight loss surgery. And in particular, patients who have been denied weight loss surgery due to their health insurance not paying for it. And what happens to those patients?
Yeah, you know, Christy, I had a patient not too long ago who had a BMI or body mass index that was 1 point below the threshold of them getting a surgery. And the irony, of course, is she needed to gain another 10 pounds and she'd be above that threshold and could have qualified for surgery. And so she's not qualifying for the surgery yet. She's tried to lose weight. And this article, which she's not been successful at, and this article would suggest that she is going to have worse health than if she had actually gotten the surgery.
Well, this was a study that looked at the medical records of 587 patients who had gastric bypass surgery and compared with 189 patients who were eligible for the surgery. So they met all the criteria, but their insurance providers just denied it and said, well, we won't pay for it.
Because it's expensive,
sure.
Or maybe there's a couple – you have to have some maybe diabetes or some other things in order to get it for that insurer.
Right. So after 3 years, they followed these people out and found the people who had the surgery, no surprise, had dropped in their weight, and less than 1% of the patients who had had the surgery developed any new health problems related to their obesity. However, the ones who didn't get the surgery,
they had problems.
They sure did. More than
40% had developed hypertension, 34% this sleep apnea, which is really bad for the lungs and the heart.
And nearly 20% developed gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD. So, I mean, it really shows that by not paying for the surgery that they needed and were eligible for, that there are other costs that then come down the road.
Yeah, penny wise, pound foolish, literally.
Literally.
I mean, you're cutting your feet off. You know, it just doesn't make any sense here. And I'm hoping with healthcare reform, Christy, that we're going to start to see a little bit more rational, particularly also since the cost of this weight loss surgery is coming down. Maybe this was a cost issue that they couldn't see beyond the tomorrow's pocketbook.
Right. So the last one is about recall disclosure, about companies and in particular pharmaceutical companies, whether or not they should be required to tell the public the details about what they've recalled.
Yeah, this was in the New York Times. I love this because, you know, it's true. You know, McDonald's, they had to recall 12 million Shrek-themed glasses because of a little bit of cadmium.
That is really something that has potential to cause health problems with really long-term exposure.
Yeah, Toyota was recalling 138,000, it was pretty precise, Lexus vehicles.
And that had something to do with contaminated valve springs in certain cars that could potentially cause problems.
And then we heard that Johnson & Johnson was recalling 21 lots. Remember last few months how difficult it was to get Tylenol, Motrin, or Benadryl?
I do remember.
Because of perhaps mold or musty odor emanating from them?
It's true. I do remember that. And it's interesting that McNeil, the company, has not given very much information about how many about all the details. How many bottles of pills does that
– Right. What's a lot? How many pills or bottles are in a lot? Is this tens of millions, hundreds of millions, tens of thousands? And does that matter?
Right. Well, and I think the interesting thing is that they were a bit evasive when someone called from the New York Times to find out more details, that they didn't want to give all the details. And so that raises the question of should they, and should they be required, and what do we expect of them?
Well, I think as a consumer – well, let's start off. As a physician, I was struck by the shortages out there for patients, and we were telling them to go get Tylenol or acetaminophen or ibuprofen, and there were shortages and difficulty to get them, and I was surprised it was that pervasive. So 21 lots may not be the same thing for me as a provider as 200 million pills or something like that.
Sure. And as a provider, I would like to know the full details about it so that I can be aware if there was some alternative to give to my patient or be able to counsel my patient. You may not be able to find it out there
I think we're in agreement here that drug companies at this point in time should be no different than other consumer companies. And the more detailed and more information to people, the better. And that's one of our take-home research that matters. We've also talked about weight loss surgery and discrimination.
And vitamin D and asthma attacks in children.
And finally, getting bad news, maybe taking a time out and a breath to really hear what's being said.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Phil Sloan and Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman about nursing homes and assisted living. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking about really the aging of America and something that's really important to all of us, which is about nursing homes, assisted living. As we get older, where do we go? Can we even stay in our homes?
And we'd like to welcome two experts in this field, Dr. Phil Sloan and Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman. And I'll first introduce you, Dr. Sloan. Dr. Sloan is a geriatrician and health services researcher with a long history of clinical work and research involving care of older persons, especially those with Alzheimer's disease. He co-edits two textbooks aimed at students, Primary Care Geriatrics and Essentials for Family Medicine. He is an active researcher in the care of older persons, which includes studies of medical care in assisted living and nursing homes, drugs prescribing, falls prevention, management of behavioral symptoms and dementia, tub design and bathing outcomes, community-based alternatives to nursing home care, and quality of life. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and co-director of the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil Shepps Center for Health Services Research at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We're glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
We're also glad to have Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman with us, who's a Keenan's Distinguished Professor of Social Work and Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill. And she co-directs as well the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Shepps Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Zimmerman has also conducted studies about care and quality of life in nursing homes and assisted living settings. Her projects have focused on dementia care, end-of-life care, medication management, and health care services, and she's the chairperson of the advisory board for the National Center for Excellence in Assisted Living and is on the board of directors of the Consumer Consortium on Assisted Living. Welcome to the show, Dr. Zimmerman.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, we are thrilled to have you with us, and certainly Adam and I, and seeing patients at the UNC Family Medicine Center, are seeing more and more of the importance of really understanding the different issues as it relates to our aging population, and are grateful to have geriatricians who are doing important research. I wonder if you might share with us a little bit about how this became your passion. We know it's important, but how did it become exciting to you?
Are people, geriatricians and people interested in geriatric research, made or are they born?
I think they're made, and I think they're made gradually and for different reasons. For me, I just kind of fell into it because I realized that it was an under-researched area and an underserved population, and I began doing clinical work and felt that what I did made a difference.
And I would agree. One of the things about working with older adults is a little bit can go a long way. There's older adults can tend to be isolated. They might not have a lot of family supports. They might have some functional limitations. And just providing a little bit of help and a little bit of care can really increase their quality of life dramatically. So I, too, have found that it's something that ends up being a calling. And once people get invested in it, you find that you're really drawn to it.
I think it's we're so grateful that you are doing this because, you know, I don't know if people really appreciate that. You know, there are, you know, if and this is 2004, so I'm sure it's even more. But the data at that time, I saw that there were over 16,000 nursing homes in the U.S., almost 2 million nursing home beds. And these were 86% full. I mean, it's not like that these are empty beds. People are at these facilities. And the average length of time since they came in was 830 days, over 2 years. So people are spending a large amount of time here. This is a huge issue.
And part of Adam, that's such an important point because years ago we used to think nursing homes were where people went to get medical care. I mean, they're called nursing homes after all. But what we've started to learn over the last 5 or 10 years, or perhaps not learn but realize, is that people are living their lives here. They're not just getting nursing care. So the whole idea about now thinking about quality of life and what it means to live life in nursing homes and assisted living and other residential settings has gone well beyond the whole idea about needing medical care.
So if you think of these as long-term care facilities or places where people go for long-term really living and care, what are you doing? What sort of research are you doing and what are you discovering about how to do that well?
One of the ironic things about long-term care settings is nobody ever thinks about them very much until they need one. And so the settings tend to be ignored and they tend to be decried by the population. Everybody says, well, we hate nursing homes, you know, and I don't want to ever be there. And then all of a sudden you have to go to one or your mother has to go to one. And people aren't prepared to kind of deal with the system. And yet the system generally has people that are doing the best they can considering the constraints and the field.
What kind of constraints are you talking about?
Well, the constraints are really, first of all, the population is ill and has a lot of problems and needs a lot of care. And secondly, there's no end to the amount of funding that you could provide. And yet so much is tied up in things like regulations, monitoring, things that don't necessarily affect individual quality of life.
And it's costly to provide this care. And yet do people have the resources to access this type of care? And these are just the basic questions, I assume. These are not the kinds of questions that we would like to know, which is this a good quality nursing home or not, which is, I guess, as a patient or if it's my mother would be the thing I would want to know.
The resource question is a real tough one because they're expensive and you want good care. Oh, gee, it really depends on the setting, but you're talking in the $50,000 to $80,000 a year range.
Wow.
For nursing homes, yeah.
And there is also a lot of navigating how to get into one. I was just working on the inpatient service at UNC Hospitals, and there may be one that a particular family might want a family member to go to, but the insurance complexities and the regulations of who is available makes it also very challenging for people. And that's just a shame. I guess that's part of the destructuring of our system here in the United States. Can we learn from systems that do work in terms of providing options for patients?
Well, ironically, our system really isn't that bad if you look internationally. Europe and Japan are ahead of us because they have an older population and they've thought more about this. And they really have some very well-developed systems, but they're running out of money. And they're starting to look to us to try to figure out how you can have private and public options that work together rather than doing everything publicly.
Well, you know, before we get into maybe understanding the macro level, let me just come down to a real basic question here is how do I ensure that my loved one gets good quality care? What should I be looking for? What are the things that you as researchers say matter?
Well, one thing that matters is not taking an adversarial approach to the people that you're working with. If your loved one goes to a facility, first of all, go there a lot because the squeaky wheel does get the grease, and then be nice about it. Don't act.
Why?
Because if you're not nice about it, people will really ignore you.
Okay.
Well, and I think what goes along with that, and it's similar to what Dr. Sloan said earlier, is that, I mean, it is really challenging to provide care for so many people in a nursing home or an assisted living community when you've got limited resources, especially limited staffing resources. I mean, the staff can only do so many things at one time and attend to so many people at one time. And families, when they go in and if they see that their family member perhaps needed to have some change with their incontinence product changed or needs fresh water next to the bedside, to understand that, you know, the staff might not necessarily have been available at that exact moment to provide it to them. And that's the type of level of understanding that I assume that we're talking about now. It's not just looking the other way if bad care is being provided.
So it's advocating for your loved one, but doing it nicely and understanding that your loved one may not be the only person who needs attention at that moment.
Right. And that families actually can help out, too. That's been part of the issue over the years, is that because there is a lot of money that's being paid for nursing home care or assisted living care, and families go in and assume that all of these services are being provided. But, you know, they still depend on families doing their share. So if you need a fresh bucket of water next to the bedside, well, the families can help out with that.
Now, you've been doing a study about how to help families working with people in nursing homes. Is that right?
That is actually exactly right. The National Institute on Aging has funded a study where we have been working with families in more than 20 nursing homes and assisted living communities here in North Carolina, in our region here, to help families think and understand ways that they can do something when they go visit the nursing home or assisted living community to actually help improve the quality of life of the family member they have there. Because oftentimes families go to these settings and they don't know what to do. They go and they sit next to the bedside or sit in the day room or
so you're making them, you're making them an active participant rather than a passive observer.
Exactly. And families want to be active participants.
Sure.
And we've just been getting really some great reports about families really kind of being energized and doing things not just for their own family member, but for the other people who live there.
So more of a service-oriented approach while you're there.
Exactly.
I know we need to take a short break, but when we come back, I want to really – let's pick up on this conversation. I really want to hear more about your research because, I mean, these are fascinating because it's challenging perhaps what is conventional wisdom. And that's the sort of thing I just love, both personally, but I just think it's not intuitive. And so we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guests, Dr. Phil Sloan and Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Phil Sloan and Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman about nursing homes and assisted living. And before the break, we talked about wanting to have a little conversation with you about your research and how you've really challenged some conventional wisdom about caring for older persons. Wondered if you'd share a little bit about what you've discovered.
One of the studies we did that we thought was particularly successful involved looking at something as simple as bathing. We found that people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias often would be scared of the bath. They would fight people who bathed them, and then they would get bathed anyway, and it would be a bad experience for everybody. We worked with some psychologists, with some nursing experts, and tried to figure out ways to make it more pleasant, and found that indeed we could not only reduce agitation and make people have a more pleasant experience, but everybody had a better experience. And eventually the field has changed so that instead of people feeling like someone needs to be forced to bathe, it's all about making people want to.
So what are the steps that you can do to make a bathing experience better for someone and safer?
It has to be individualized. Everybody's different. Some people like one thing. Some people like it another. Some people have to be bathed in bed. Some people have to be bathed in a shower. Some in a tub. Some in the morning. Some in the afternoon.
But willing to make it more personal for that particular individual.
Right. For example, hair washing was always a problem in some of the studies we did, but we found that one of the reasons was because the hair was done last and people would be really tired and kind of strung out. And if you just did the hair differently, did it another time and made it like a beauty parlor. If you act like it's a beauty parlor, it brings in the memories that people are used to acting normally and having somebody take care of them, because people are used to bathing themselves, and having somebody else do it creates stress. And so it's the whole idea of understanding where the person is coming from, particularly if they have Alzheimer's or something they don't quite understand. So you have to figure out where their head is and help them with it.
I mean, those are just some great examples of things that would not be, you know, I would come into the nursing home with my loved ones thinking, oh, yes, we get our bath at 10 a.m. Dr. Zimmerman, are in your own work, what types of things, either in medications or end-of-life care or dementia, you know, are there some things that you're involved in as well that really you've kind of said there's this aha moment that it doesn't have to be this way?
Well, I think the bathing example is probably the most cogent one, is that the aha moment is if we would think about what it would be like for any of us to all of a sudden transplant ourselves into a nursing home and say, okay, it's 10 o'clock in the morning, we're going to take you into this bathing room, we're going to strip off your clothes, and we're going to start rubbing you down and cleaning your hair and doing whatever all else, you know, we need to do for to clean you, and you not fully understanding what's happening. I mean, if you just think about that, any of us can understand that that's not going to be a pleasant experience. I mean, even if you didn't have a dementia, it wouldn't be a pleasant experience. And with that being a good example, it really speaks to the fact that what's happening throughout the whole long-term care system now is people stepping back and thinking about a new culture of long-term care. And the phrase that has been now being spoken about for quite some time is called culture change. And changing, and with, again, bathing being a good example, the whole culture, the whole way about thinking about what these settings are and the kind of care they provide, and changing those perspectives and the ways we'd been doing it for so many years, because we don't want to have people having to receive care in places that they dread to go to.
I remember my father, when he was in the hospital, this is a hospital setting, but he'd be woken up at 4 in the morning to get weighed. And it drove him furious because he couldn't go back to sleep. Mm-hmm. And he's sleeping in the hospital. And the question was, why were they always going to do it? Well, that's the time they weighed people at 4 in the morning.
Right.
I was like, I can't believe this, you know, sort of thing. I hope these things – do those sort of practices, though, of routine, let's do it the same way because it's the way we – is that still the norm in many nursing homes around the country?
It is the norm in many – nursing homes, and also is in hospitals, as you said. And I think this whole culture change idea can apply to all of healthcare. One of the things people think about is are we trying to do healthcare like from a military perspective, or are we trying to do service from like a hotel perspective? And if you think that way, you know, no hotel would ever tell you got to be out of your room at 8 o'clock, you got to have breakfast at 8,
right.
You know, and you got to be dressed.
Check out time is at 6 a.m.
Right. But in thinking about culture change, I mean, part of that is, I mean, we have more and more older Americans moving and needing long-term care services, and that is what we have here in America. But we also learned from other countries that really promote older people being able to live in their own homes, in their own environment. So it sounds like part of what you're doing is changing the culture in these long-term care facilities to make it more natural, less like the military style and more like a hotel perhaps. But also thinking about how can we promote people living in their own homes a little bit longer? And I know there's a new and exciting model of doing that called PACE. Dr. Sloan, I wonder if you'd teach us about that.
Well, if I could back up a little bit and give it a little context.
Sure.
Being in this field of aging, I think, is an exciting time because the baby boomers have, throughout their lives, changed the culture of the society. And I just can't wait to see what's going to happen over the next 20 years in terms of long-term care. What I do think will happen is there will be a lot of diversification, a lot of very different alternatives, and a lot more choices, some of which, many of which, are going to involve people doing things outside of the traditional long-term care system. And among the examples are this program of all-inclusive care for the elderly, which is called PACE. It's a model that was developed over many, many years and now is a regular Medicare provider. And it's a program that's built around a day program and a multidisciplinary team that takes very intensive care for people who live at home and their caregivers, tries to keep them out of the hospital, and tries to keep them as managing at home and as healthy as possible. Brings them into this day center, provides a lot of health care, but also activities, monitoring, socialization, and really creates a community that helps support people who are very frail.
Wow, that's incredibly exciting. You know, we're going to have to wrap up in a minute, but I'd like to get just from each of you just, you know, maybe one prediction, you know, 20 years from now, or one hope that you have, one aspiration you have for where this field would be in 20 years. And maybe one piece of advice you would have for those of us who might be 20 years from now in this field, literally. What advice and what prediction?
Well, I think my prediction would be that things are going to keep changing because they have been changing, right? 10 years ago, we talked about nursing homes. We've got assisted living now. We've got PACE programs. And there's all different types of morphing of different housing and services types of opportunities. So that's not even so much a prediction. That's almost a given that things will be changing. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the advice, it's all personal. And so when a person for themselves or for their family is looking for where they're going to be getting care for long term or even short term, because there are so many options, look carefully and choose what feels right for you. Because so far, that seems to be the most important component about whether or not a person's going to have a good quality of life and good outcomes is whether the fit between who that person was and what the setting is providing is appropriate.
That's good advice. What about you, Dr. Sloan?
I have so many things to choose from. One thing, we did a study about what would happen if dementia medications that were really effective developed. And what would happen is people would stay at home and maybe never go into nursing homes, but there would be a lot more need for home services. So I think and a take-home message I would have is that if you're looking at a long-term care insurance policy and you're going to put money into it, make sure it allows you to purchase alternatives that don't exist now. Because otherwise, what will happen is what you'll want to do, you won't be able to afford.
Oh, wow. That's really good advice in helping us look ahead.
And we really do appreciate not only really talking about what is now, but really, really thinking carefully about a very personal approach, as you mentioned, Dr. Zimmerman. We thank you both for being our guest today. We appreciate it. We're going to need to take a break, but when we come back, we will be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, we're going to spend some time talking about your health questions, experiences, and attitudes towards medical care.
You can write us or call us, and we will address your comments on an upcoming show. You can send the comments at yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can call us at 966-8081. And we'd like to ask our wonderful executive producer, Julie Steiner, to read us our first house call today.
Our first listener writes, "My mother went to see her doctor not too long ago with lots of chronic coughing. She is 80 years old and has never smoked. Her doctor did some tests and told her she has bronchiectasis. What exactly is this? It sounds really bad."
Well, it's a big word. I will say that. It's one of our bigger words that, you know, it's one of those things that in medical school we didn't get too much training on, but we see occasionally, so she's not alone.
It's similar to other chronic lung diseases like something you hear about, COPD, which can be related to smoking, usually is. And bronchiectasis is similar in that it has an inflammation of the airways, some obstruction to airflow, and you can have more visits to the doctor and more hospitalizations related to this chronic daily cough with coughing up some productive what we call sputum or mucus.
Yeah, and there's a couple maybe distinctions from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or emphysema, which is that bronchiectasis a lot of times is actually not necessarily related to smoking.
Sure.
We don't really know what causes it. And the other thing is you want to treat your loved ones. If they get coughing increased more often, they're going to have to take antibiotics more frequently. So they're going to have to really work with their primary care doctor, their pulmonologist on a much more frequent basis. But on the other hand, they can live a really pretty much normal lifespan. It won't necessarily get a whole lot worse like emphysema, which can be, just be fatal.
And I'd also encourage you – I mean this is more common in women, more common in older people. But if your mother's had this diagnosis and you're not quite sure and you want to hear more about what it really means for her, to go with her to that appointment and talk with the doctor about what it really means.
How do we spell bronchiectasis? Let's spell that for our listeners out there.
B-R-O-N-C-H-I-E-C-T-A-S-I-S.
Okay. We said it once. We're not going to risk it by saying it again. Julie, what's our next house call?
I am a nurse and I work strange hours. I take Ambien for sleep since I have to rotate my sleep schedule. And I'm finding that I really can't sleep well without a half of a tablet. Should I be worried about this?
Well, that's a tough little question. A short but tough one.
That is a tough one. I mean, people can get used to taking Ambien or taking sleep medications. In this case, I mean, my take is that it's not really a worry considering your unusual sleep schedule, but you might think about sleep hygiene, which is something we use to say things like being in a dark room and sleeping where it's quiet without interruptions.
Yeah, and in addition, most doctors and even insurance companies really don't want you to be taking things like Ambien on a daily basis. And so when you actually – if your doctor writes for 30 tablets, a lot of times they'll only fill 15 tablets. And so really you're going to have to – half the days of the month at least more likely get used to sleeping without it. So some people will actually take other medicines during other days, some common antihistamines, some other types of medicines – some of which actually have side effects which could be worse than the Ambien, so I can understand why you might not want to take them. But it's a difficult question here. Particularly, you're a nurse and taking Ambien, there's all kinds of little things going on here.
Well, but having such – working sometimes the night shift and sometimes the day shift. I understand that. But don't forget the importance of exercise and how that can really help you sleep. So I just add that tidbit in there.
Yeah. Not sure we gave the best answer, but it's a starting place. Julie, what's next?
I've heard about American children being really obese, and I'm concerned about my child's weight. He is 9 years old and is high on the scale my doctor looks at, the BMI for age. He eats pretty much like my other children, although I do find extra snack wrappers under his bed. And he is very active, yet I guess he is overweight. Apparently, his cholesterol is high, too. We're trying to make changes, but it's hard since my other kids are on the thin side. Any suggestions?
Wow, that is a tough situation and sadly a common situation.
Well, and in this particular case, it suggests that one of your children maybe has a slightly different genetic makeup, maybe a metabolic profile, some things going on that makes his case a little different than the other children. So you're going to have to do some things differently, I think, for this particular child.
And it's also tough if you're finding extra snack wrappers and those things under his bed for a child who is independent enough to go into the closet and get food out of the pantry that maybe you don't know about. So we can offer a few tips, but this is a definitely a complicated problem.
Yeah, one of the things I would say is slow down your meal time a little bit. A lot of times, particularly kids, we eat really, really fast, and maybe the adults eat really, really fast. And whereas the younger kids get by with this, maybe this child, by eating fast, will eat more. And by slowing down the eating, the child will eat less at each meal.
I would also say avoid the sugar drinks like sodas and juices chips and candy, and just try not to even have them in the house. The other kids, even though they're thin, they don't need that either. So you might as well just not even have it there, and then he can't go get it at night.
You may want to look at the types of foods they're eating. So, you know, getting the lower calorie foods, things that are less in fat, particularly since the cholesterol seems to be a little bit high, and also the portions. You know, most kids eat whatever it is you give them, so give him a little bit less. He's 9 years old. He's not probably coming up with all of his own portions. So it's going to take some real discipline on your part, but we're going to encourage it.
And I'd say also pay attention to increasing activities, sports activities, and limiting TV. And you could also talk to your doctor about seeing a nutritionist who could sit down and really help you come up with a family meal plan as well.
Yeah. Well, good luck, and keep us informed. What's our very last house call, Julie?
What is the best brand of sunscreen for babies and toddlers?
Well, the short answer here. Yeah, what's the trick here?
Well, there's no best brand, but the trick the the trick is that really we should be avoiding the sun altogether.
Right. The best brand is avoidance with an SPF of 100%. 100%. Keeping the child, particularly babies and toddlers, there's no reason to have them have direct contact in the sun. So if you go to the beach, keep them under an umbrella, keep them covered with clothing that can prevent sun exposure at that level.
And the clothing, well, avoiding the sun during the day, during that 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. is the best. Be in the shade, and clothes are far more effective than any sunscreen you can apply. But if you do apply it, and if you, they are going to be in the sun, I would recommend an SPF of – they've got – they say over 30, but now they have over 50 that you can get, making sure that it has UVA and UVB protection.
And even UVC protection, which tend to be the more expensive ones, avoiding the oils. If you put oil in that child, you're probably going to have to go see a lawyer.
And that you apply generously and frequently. So
well, I think
hopefully that helps.
That's probably going to conclude our house calls today, but we've been able to have avoidance sunscreen recommended.
Mm-hmm. Talking a little bit about nutrition and obesity in children.
Really sympathizing and empathizing with those whose work schedules really cause sleep disturbances and know it's not easy.
Mm-hmm. And a funny word for a complicated medical term called bronchiectasis. So thank you for writing us, and thank you for being with us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We want you to share your questions and experiences by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu and or calling us at 919-966-8081. You can follow us online at yourhealthradio.org or on Twitter by searching for Your Health Radio at twitter.com.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our wonderful producer, Julie Steiner, and our guests today, Drs. Phil Sloan and Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Take care.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.